You are listening to the Kangli Qinghua China in the World podcast, a series of conversations with Chinese and international experts on China's foreign policy, international role, and China's relations with the world. Brought to you from the Kangli Qinghua Center for Global Policy, located in Beijing. I am Tong Zhao, an associate in Carnegie's nuclear policy program based at the Carnegie Qinghua Center for Global Policy in Beijing. I will be your host today. I'm delighted to be joined by Albert Kobe. Albert Kobe is the Robert Gates Fellow at the Center for New American Security, where he focuses on strategic deterrence, nuclear weapons, conventional force, intelligence, and related issues. Okay, so from the American perspective, given this likelihood of greater escalation risks, what's your prescription to U.S. policymakers? So the Obama administration is making a lot of efforts to try to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in American overall national security strategy. So do you think, as you argued, to deal with this, potential Chinese conventional capability and to deal with the greater risks of escalation, do you think U.S. should reverse the effort to reduce the role of nuclear weapons and actually raise the role of nuclear weapons? And, this probably will occur during Secretary of Defense Carter's tenure or even, beyond. But Carter, as we know, he himself is an expert on nuclear policy. He has written books on nuclear strategy, on strategic issues. So he is no layman to nuclear weapons. He not only knows the politics around nuclear weapons, he also knows the, physical, operational, technical details about nuclear weapons. So first, I think the first part of this question is, what do you think Secretary Carter will do about nuclear weapons? Is he going to continue Obama's efforts to reduce the role, or is he going to raise the role of nuclear weapons? And second part of the question is, what do you think should be the right policy?
Right. Those are two different questions, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So I don't know Carter particularly well at all, but I do know his work. And Carter, I kind of, this is my shorthand, this is the RAND Democrats, which is, sort of, there's a species of Democratic national security expert, Ash Carter, Jim Miller, Ted Warner, who are very serious national security thinkers. They're basically, kind of realistic and pragmatic, and they acknowledge the importance of a strong defense, but they look for ways to minimize risks and to, fold in arms control. And I mean, to some extent, that's what everybody does, but this is I think, an identifiable group, anthropologically, if you will. And I think, my sense about Carter is that he's going to operate with some significant constraints from the White House. This president has committed himself and his administration very much to reducing nuclear weapons and reducing their role. So I think Carter will have to acknowledge that political reality, but at the same time, my guess is that, and I think he's interested in non-proliferation measures and appropriate arms control measures, but my guess is that Carter will, his previous record indicates that he supports a strong, enduring U.S. nuclear force, nuclear deterrent. So my guess is that he'll, acknowledge the rhetorical interest in arms control and the reduction of the role of nuclear weapons, but that in practice, his Pentagon will move forward in kind of rebuilding, modernizing the U.S. nuclear arsenal and the U.S. Nuclear deterrent. I mean, the consensus in the United States is that arms control with Russia is basically dead for the foreseeable future. And so, meaningful steps towards a world free of nuclear weapons or disarmament don't seem very plausible in the next 2 years of the Obama administration. So, but there are the beginning of a big recapitalization of the U.S. nuclear force, and Carter is pretty much on record as supporting that. So I would expect him to be on the sort of, the U.S. needs a strong nuclear deterrent, but without fundamentally changing the, at least the, without fundamentally changing the policy that the Obama administration has pursued, which is kind of a rhetorical focus on disarmament and a desire and aspiration to do arms control and disarmament stuff, but at the same time recapitalizing the nuclear force. My own view is that's great, and that's makes sense, and that's very good for given the constraints that this, you know, that he will have in this administration, that Carter will have in this administration. But you know, over the medium term, you know, my recommendation would be to kind of for the United States not to abandon the goal of controlling nuclear risks, no, never that, and reducing nuclear danger. That's always good, mm-hmm. But to acknowledge that and deal with the reality that nuclear weapons and the U.S. nuclear forces are going to play a central and foundational role in U.S. strategic posture and military posture and defense posture and broader strategy for the foreseeable future, particularly if the United States is going to continue to play this leading role in the world, which I think it will and should. Mm-hmm. And so what that says to me is that the U.S. policy, it's a little bit of a quibbling words, but I think it's important. The U.S. should seek to minimize the extent to which it relies on nuclear weapons, but that judgment should depend on strategic context, okay. Right? So, you know, Russia has reintroduced aggression and the use of force and the threat of escalation into Europe. So, you know, the U.S. will need to respond. You know, we would like to reduce reliance on nuclear weapons, but with Russia behaving that way, I think nuclear weapons and military force will become more a part of the European theater because that's a response. Mm-hmm. In the Pacific, I think, you know, China's very substantial military buildup is going to force the United States to adapt its military posture and its strategic posture in the region. I think first and foremost that means that the U.S. Is going to try to maintain conventional advantage, mm-hmm. even if it's shrunk, mm-hmm. which I think is what the U.S. is trying to do, and that's all to the good. But I also think the U.S. is going to have to think a bit more about its nuclear policy here, which has been kind of out of mind for the last generation or so, because the scale of China's military buildup and the reality of existing of enduring tensions and disagreements means that, you know, unfortunately, conflict is possible, and so the United States needs to think about that. And so, you know, my view is we should speak more frankly,
okay.
about what it is that we expect nuclear weapons to do, and the way that I would talk about that is to say the U.S. is always interested in ways of reducing nuclear risks and nuclear dangers, but the U.S. also recognizes that nuclear weapons are an enduring part of U.S. strategy and a stable order. And we won't shy away from that, and we'll build the capabilities and posture our forces in the way necessary to make that posture credible and effective.
So basically, the United States needs a more flexible nuclear capability and posture.
I think that's right. A more flexible, more discriminate, and a more adapted nuclear posture, yeah.
I think you used the term, the word tailored in your writings, which I think captures your thinking very, very accurately. So if the United States is going to obtain a more tailored or more flexible nuclear capability and nuclear employment policy, what are the practical implications for the current U.S. nuclear modernization programs? Because as we know, all the three legs of the U.S. nuclear triad need to be modernized in the future. And the discussion is ongoing right now about how to modernize them. So there are already plans to replace the old systems, the strategic bombers, the silo-based ICBMs, the nuclear submarines with, you know, next-generation systems. So besides those programs, what additional things need to be done to make U.S. nuclear capability more flexible, more tailored? Does that mean, you know, U.S. needs to resume nuclear tests to deploy, you know, more advanced and tailored tactical nuclear weapons? Does it mean the U.S. needs to develop some particular types of delivery systems? So what's the implication for the nuclear modernization in the future?
So no, it's a good question. Well, first of all, it shouldn't involve testing, which would, you know, anything that would require us to test should be disfavored. But I think there's some hardware changes that the U.S. might need. I think the recapitalization, the triad, and a lot of the platforms and systems that are being planned for are the appropriate ones. But I think a lot of it's also in the sort of software, so to speak, which is to say the plans, the strategies, the doctrines for thinking about employment of nuclear weapons, also the command and control capabilities, as well as the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. Basically, the ability to use nuclear weapons in a more controlled way, which is not to say that they would be used as warfighting tools. They would not be treated like other weapons, but they are be treated. Actually, the Russians are thinking along these lines. But basically, that you would use nuclear weapons essentially as political weapons, but in a tailored way. And the United States needs to be prepared, first and foremost, to respond to that kind of use. You know, we don't want to get caught with our pants down, so to speak, if you'll forgive the kind of crude expression. But also to be able to deal in the worst case with a loss of conventional superiority. So I think this is actually not going to take a massive change in the, you know, kind of program of record, as the U.S. calls it, or in its posture. But it is going to take a change in the software of how the U.S. thinks about its nuclear posture and nuclear employment.
Okay. So going back to your general argument about conventional gap and more flexible nuclear posture, does the term that, you know, using nuclear weapons to compensate for conventional inferiority, does that accurately describe your argument, or how is your argument different from that?
Well, I mean, my argument includes the possibility of relying on nuclear weapons to compensate for conventional inferiority. I mean, the Americans don't talk about this, but it's still implicit in our policy that the U.S. is prepared to use nuclear weapons to compensate for conventional inferiority. I mean, even the Obama administration did not even reach a sole purpose or a no first use pledge, right? So, and the countries that were not covered by the no first use pledge are also the countries that could plausibly pose a challenge of being conventionally superior to the United States. So that's always been part of U.S. Doctrine, okay. And I think if it didn't get removed in 2010, it's never going to get removed. Practically speaking.
Okay.
So this is what my thinking about is more about adapting, I think, the U.S. nuclear policy and posture to the emerging strategic realities.
Okay.
And sort of taking something that has a little bit been in amber since the Cold War, and kind of making it responsibly adaptable to the current and the emerging environment, not to make nuclear weapons more usable because we want to use nuclear weapons. That's the last thing we want, but to continue to have them be strategically relevant and effective in this new environment.
Okay, I think that makes a lot of sense from the American perspective. But I'm also curious about how do you think the Chinese and Russians would, see this argument, right? That China, we had a very weak conventional military capability vis-a-vis the United States for a very long time, and China refrained from overly depending on nuclear weapons to compensate its conventional inferiority. So apparently China does not necessarily subscribe to the idea of using nuclear to compensate for conventional inferiority. And how would the Russians see this? Because the conventional gap between Russia and the United States is becoming greater and greater, as a matter of fact. So how would your argument be perceived by Russians? Because they might argue, you know, maybe we Russians should also think more about nuclear weapons. Let nuclear weapons playing a bigger role, let it playing a more flexible role. How do you control the potential consequences of such reaction dynamics between the major nuclear powers?
Excellent question. I mean, you're exactly right to ask that question. Let's talk about Russia first. First of all, Russia is already doing that. So Russia is already much more reliant on its nuclear weapons and willing to introduce them into international and regional politics than the U.S. and NATO. And I mean, I think if you watch Russian nuclear signaling, both rhetorical and also their operations in the last year in particular, it's very suggestive. So what I'm talking about would be, in the Russia context, would be a moral response, would be really an adaptation to Russia's behavior, but also its military modernization plan. I'm not sure it's correct to say that the U.S. Advantage over Russia is growing. I think the Russians have actually had a pretty formidable military modernization plan over the last 10 years. And certainly in a contest beyond Russia's near abroad, the Russians would be in a lot of trouble. But Russia has substantial capability in its near abroad and in the former Soviet area that's pretty significant. And I think they're aware of that. And of course, the NATO military capability, particularly outside the United States, has diminished quite a bit. So that's a real challenge. So I think, what I'm talking about in the Russia case is really just dealing with the Russians doing exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, in some sense, I think the Russians have a good nuclear strategy. I mean, I worry that they may be too aggressive with it. Since I mean, what my argument is that more or less everybody could have my nuclear strategy, but should have it for status quo purposes. Mm-hmm. The Russians are not a status quo power, so that kind of violates my rule of a stable equilibrium among the great powers. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the Russia context. But let's talk about with China, because I think you bring up an interesting point, because I think China has been restrained in its nuclear posture, and for a long time its conventional military posture was more restrained. But I think, look. There's a reality, which is that China has built up its military and continues to be appearing to build up its military in a way that's designed, it seems to me, first to make U.S. access to the effective access to the region, military access to the region, very difficult, if not impossible, depending on the context. And then more slowly, but looking forward, that China is developing more of a capability for power projection. You know, closer to China initially, but who knows in the longer term. The United States since the Second World War, has seen itself as this sort of leader of this network of like-minded states, many of which are its allies, that is good for the United States and those states, but also for countries like China, which have benefited from this broader global trading system and the restraint that this kind of network has exercised on states that China is concerned about. It's worth remembering that most U.S. alliances in Asia were originally instruments partially to restrain those allies.
Right.
China's fundamental aspect that's changing in this arrangement is China's military power, and it's intruding into the post-war space of the United States in maritime Asia. Now, China thinks that's legitimate. China's rising. As Mao said, China has stood up. I can understand that. I can sympathize with it. If I were Chinese, I might think very much the same way. In fact, I probably would. But let's think about the reality. If China's growing military power presents this change, it by necessity undermines the credibility and effectiveness of the American military guarantee and American military primacy in this area of maritime Asia, and thus undermines the kind of basic strategy and that basic order. The United States. There's some talk in the United States, but I don't think the United States is going to retreat to Fortress America. The United States is going to try to continue to play this role, and certainly U.S. allies and partners and others in the region want the U.S. to play this role, not just Japan, but also South Korea, Australia, Philippines, even fence sitters, Singapore, Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, etc. So the U.S. is going to try to maintain its conventional advantage. But it's possible that the United States will not be able to sustain this advantage, at least over areas that we've traditionally cared about and are part of this order. Now, this presents a really formidable problem, because if China can attain conventional superiority, then it might seek to use that leverage, either in a political contest with the implicit threat of force, or even, God forbid, in a conflict. Now, in order to prevent this from happening, the United States may seek to rely on nuclear weapons to offset this Chinese convention, do a new look.
Right.
Now, China may respond with its own nuclear buildup and be less restrained in its nuclear force, or build up, be more aggressive in its conventional capabilities. But the problem is, if China does, even if it does outfox the United States, if it does end up being superior to the United States and puts the United States in a position where its nuclear posture is not credible, not effective, then what's the deduction? Well, if you're Tokyo, or if you're other, you know, if you're other states in the region, you can either say, well, the Americans are kind of finished, and I'm going to accommodate China. Or, you know, there's some middle ground. You can try to split the difference, which maybe is more likely. But the alternative is that you say, well, the Americans can't guarantee me, and I'm afraid of being under the Chinese shadow, so I'm going to look at my own autonomous strategic capabilities. And the
Americans may say, nuclear weapons.
And the Americans may say, don't do this. But, you know, we know from the past that U.S. allies and partners have been willing to do this in the past. And the U.S. stopped them when the U.S. still had strategic superiority, had a dominance over them, over South Korea, over Taiwan several times, over Japan in the 1960s, and also in Europe. But, you know, you look at what's happening in the Middle East right now, and you hear the language from the Saudis and others. If the U.S. does lose that credibility, it may not have sufficient influence. And it's also possible the United States may say, well, you know, we're going to fight it, but we're not going to fight it too hard because this military challenge from China is too formidable. And in that case, China runs into a situation where its own strength has brought about a regional situation, which is exactly what it doesn't want, which is regional proliferation, less control over some countries that China has traditionally feared or disliked. Or had reason to be suspicious of. And then its sort of military power will be self-defeating. I mean, you know, just to wax philosophical for a second, I mean, I think China's position is not unlike Germany. I think there's a lot of parallels to Imperial Germany. But I think you know, if I were Chinese, and I'm an American, I'm a patriotic American, so I'm biased, but I try to put myself in China's shoes because, you know, part of the reason I worry about China is because I think, well, if I were Chinese, I would behave in this way, and that worries me as an American. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not because I think Chinese are doing anything sort of morally wrong. You know, I sympathize. China's back. Mm-hmm. It's powerful. It wants to be respected. It deserves that. I completely agree. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the problem for Germany was that the more powerful it became, the more it frightened its neighbors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sort of a function of geography. You know, one of the reasons that people trust the United States because we're far away. And China doesn't have that luxury, and so I think, you know, if I were China, the policy of Bismarck is the right policy, which is strong. We demand to be respected. We have, you know, we speak as Chinese. We have decisive influence in a lot of respects, but we also understand that restraint is crucial to our success. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, look, I think you know, discount what I say because I'm an American. But I also think from China's perspective, that's the right strategy. The question will be whether that can be sustained.
Okay. Since you brought up U.S. alliance in East Asia and the potential for these countries to go nuclear in the future, some non-Chinese experts have recently argued that it's in Americans' interests to actually let these allies go nuclear, to let them develop their independent nuclear weapons capability to counter the perceived growth of Chinese conventional military capacity. So would you go one step further, go to the extreme by saying that it's in American interest to see the allies go nuclear?
Well, definitely not right now. I think the United States should oppose allied proliferation under current conditions. Look, I think the existing system is the best one, which is that, or maybe it's not the best, but it's good enough. Which is, you know, the United States kind of provides a sort of, you know, oversight or sort of supervisory kind of function in security terms, and you know, we're the country that has nuclear weapons for our allies, you know, like Japan and South Korea. And I think those countries are better off with the U.S. having them rather than having independent capabilities. I think China's better off. I think that's the reality. The question is if things deteriorated, and if China, you know, pushed strongly in this direction, you know, what would I say? I think that the United States would have to look at it from a strategic point of view. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you know,
okay.
The United States would have to say we face. You know, we face a new situation. Obviously, proliferation is something that we oppose and we think is bad. But we also have to acknowledge the trade-offs. Mm-hmm. You know, and in the past, the U.S. has ultimately come around to think that some degree of, you know, or that it would rather maintain its alliances with certain countries rather than fully oppose their nuclear weapons acquisition. You know, if Japan or South Korea this year or in 5 years pursued a nuclear weapon, I think the U.S. would say this is a huge violation. You know, this could be the end. But if a kind of world emerges where you know the U.S. can't really credibly provide extended deterrence, I think the answer might well be very different.
Okay. Well, one last question, yeah. The easiest question. Given the current status of U.S.-Russian relations, given all the problems in Crimea, in Ukraine, what's your general thoughts about what will happen to NUCOM's control? I know you served as policy advisor to the Secretary of Defense representative for the New START treaty, and you saw the treaty being drafted, being negotiated, and then being ratified. So you played a role in that mm-hmm. New START treaty in NUCOM's control. So do you have any personal feeling about the current frustration over NUCOM's control, and do you see any specific potential areas for progress?
I think in some respects, nuclear arms control is now more important than it was.
Okay.
You know, I mean, my view is that the whole abolition and disarmament agenda is a red herring. It's not feasible. It's probably a bad idea. You know, and New START and that kind of thing never really were practically connected to it, but there was all this hubbub about abolition. What nuclear arms control is best for is when you're in a situation with a country that you could actually get into a fight with, mm-hmm. you want to try to find ways to mitigate those risks, both that could precipitate conflict or that could you know, generate pressures towards escalation. So given that we're actually in a position where we could actually get in a war with Russia, mm-hmm. God forbid, now is when we should be going with arms control proposals. Now, what are those arms control proposals about? Those arms control proposals should be about stability. It should not be about reducing numbers. I mean, in a sense, I would, you know, right now may not be the best time politically, but my proposals to the Russians would have nothing to do with numbers. They would have to do with, you know, understanding what, you know, U.S. programs are and are not about and what Russian programs are and are not about, with the idea that we don't want the Russians to misinterpret what we're doing.
Okay.
We want them to understand what we're doing when we're doing it. But we don't, you know, for instance, if we have a missile defense program that's about Iran or North Korea, mm-hmm. we don't want the Russians to think it's about them. You know, for instance, if we launch a missile against a North Korean missile, we don't want the Russians to think that's a prelude to an attack on Russia. We want to be able to use that missile against North Korea because we want the president to be able to say, I'm not worried about a Russian response. I'm doing this about North Korea. So that's the kind of thing that we can do with the Russians and it would actually make a difference. But that has nothing to do with getting to a world without nuclear weapons. I also think, you know, New START, when it expires in, I guess, 2020, 2021, you know, we're going to want to keep a framework with the Russians. We'll start thinking about that in a couple of years more seriously. But you know, I mean, I think the same thing applies with China. You know, and I did some work on this for CSIS a couple of years ago with some friends and colleagues. You know that you know the U.S. and China should be trying to think of constructive ideas where we could reduce risks towards escalation and so forth. Not about convincing the U.S. or China to get rid of nuclear weapons; it's not going to happen. But about you know. Avoiding misunderstandings in the midst of, you know, in a sense, so some of these CBM kind of things that we're doing with incidents at sea and preventing unnecessary or inadvertent escalation. Mm. You know, one or both sides may want to escalate deliberately, in which case that's a different story. But you don't want escalation to be a mistake.
Well, it's great to hear your very, you know, sobering insight. It's always the case that, you know, arms control is most needed when it is most difficult to achieve.
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah.
I'm very glad that, you know, we have people as talented as you are working on these most difficult issues and making a contribution to better communications between the nuclear powers. So thank you very much, Bridge, again, for spending time with me today. And that's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. If you'd like to read or learn more about nuclear policy and U.S.-China relationship,
You can find more articles, events, and podcasts on our website at www.carnegiechinhua.org. I encourage you to visit and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Chinhua Center. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next time.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.